Dr. Liz Burtengrove, and I'm the Director of Education for the Carrillo Center for Nonviolence. Welcome back to Living One, our monthly webinar series where presenters from around the world share their vision of a future in which humans and other animals live as one community in peace and wellness. Through Living One, together we attempt to answer the question, we know what's wrong, but what does right look like? This month, we welcome back author and environmental activist Derek Jensen for a special pre-recorded Living One event. Hailed as the philosopher poet of the environmental movement, Derek is the author of 27 books. Today, we'll be discussing his latest book, Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It, co-authored with Lierre Keith and Max Wilbert. As stated in the book's preface, from the bright green perspective, the unsustainable aspects of our way of life today, including large cities, are not functional problems, but rather are solvable by readily available technologies and processes. Photovoltaic cells, wind power, generators, recycling, and the like. While there is no doubt a place for innovation in society, Derek and his co-authors argue that these bright green solutions are lies that allow us to maintain an unsustainable way of living while pretending that we are not killing the planet. Today's conversation on this important topic will be guided by Carrillo's founding director, Dr. Gabe Bradshaw. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Nice to see you all again, and it's a terrific opportunity to get together. Derek, thanks so much for that. So just to start off, one of the things that's recently kind of reared what I consider its ugly head again are groups of scientists, and I guess they would also call themselves or include conservationists, who are proposing that basically somehow some design of the globe, the Earth, is made so that half of it is preserved and the rest of it is sort of tossed over to humanity in whatever ways humanity sees fit. With the central argument that, look, at least we can do something and save part of the planet. So your book, your co-authored book is extremely timely. Maybe we could start off with, some thoughts about that. What's your idea about that? What do you feel when you see, I mean, this is quite a huge number of quote unquote prominent scientists, who are used or who actually do inform policy and law.
I think that, I mean, I get your perspective that, you know, that would leave 50% of the planet to be destroyed by this culture. But frankly, 99% of the old growth is gone. 99% of the prairies are gone. And there are a very small number of undammed rivers remaining. And as a minimal step, I would be absolutely delighted if 50% of the rivers were, if the dams on 50% of rivers were taken out post haste, I would be delighted. And then we can move toward 75%, and then we can move toward 95%, and then we can move toward 100%. And if 50% of the prairies were restored, I would be delighted as an intermediate step. And if 50% of the oceans were put off limits to fishing, I would be delighted as an intermediate step. So I don't have, I mean, what I know is that prior to the beginnings of this culture, Iraq was cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. And the first written myth of Western civilization is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq to make a great city. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna, and the Near East was heavily forested, and the North Africa was heavily forested. And those went down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. Greece was heavily forested. The islands in the Mediterranean were not originally rocky. The rocks were where they're supposed to be, underneath the soil. And there were penguins in the Northern Hemisphere. I don't know if many people know this, but they were not related to the Southern Hemisphere penguins, but they were called penguins, which means fat ones. because penguins are kind of chubby, and these were great auks, and they were as far south as France, and the last one was killed in the 19th century. We've all heard accounts, or those of us who attend have heard accounts of whales being so thick in the North Atlantic that they were a hazard to shipping. And banks of cod were so thick that ships would slow their passage. And early European explorers said all they had to do was drop a basket in the water and they would pull up, they'd be full of cod when they pulled it up. And, you know, no matter where we go, we can read stories like this of, you know, even the 1930s, the Klamath River was black and roiling with fish and with salmon. And the last few years, the Indians along the Klamath have had to cut short or cancel some of their salmon ceremonies because there's no salmon. And, you know, all my work is based on the idea or based on the understanding that if you have uncountable salmon and then you can count them, and then after that there's a million, and then there's a half a million, and then there's a quarter million, and then there's 100,000, that we can see where the trend is going. And if I had to sum up all of my work in one sentence, it would be that this culture will not last forever. And when it's over, I would prefer that there be more of the world left rather than less. And I frankly don't care how we get there. There are 2 million dams in the United States over, there are 2 million dams over, I think it's, I don't remember the height. I think it's 6 feet tall, and there are 70,000 dams over 12 feet tall, I think. So I don't remember the numbers exactly. I mean, the numbers are correct, but not the heights. Anyway, there's 70,000 tall dams in the United States. And if we only took out one of those dams a day, it would take 365 days a year. So that's 7,000 days. In 20 years, it would take us 200 years to take out those dams. And salmon don't have that time, and sturgeon don't have that time. And I'm really glad that they're taking out dams on the Klamath. And I don't care if it's done through a legal agreement like that or if it's done because there is a big rainstorm. I mean, what I know from the river's perspective is the river needs to run free again. And it's the same with, I don't care how we get back to prairie. I don't care how we get back to old growth, except, of course, it takes time. I don't care how we get back to native forest, I should say. And this really brings me to Bright Green Lies, where one of the central points of Bright Green Lies, and we can talk about the solar and all that stuff later, but that's not the real point here at this moment. The real point is that once upon a time, environmentalism was about saving wild places and wild beings. And over the last few decades, it has transformed into being about perpetuating this culture. And perpetuating this culture that is the source of the destructiveness. And so one of the reasons we wrote this book is because we want our movement back, and we want to return environmentalism to being about saving wild places and wild beings, as opposed to trying to sustain the dominant culture.
How did that change occur? And what, you know, in terms of the hijacking, you might call it, or how did that central goal and mission change, and who was involved in doing that or being engaged in that?
Well, it's a really good question. And it's, if we want to misuse a word, I mean, that is the natural history of movements. I would say the unnatural history of movements. That is something that this culture just excels at, is taking a movement for justice or a movement for social change and co-opting it to serve the ends of capital. And this happens to, I mean, it's extraordinary. It's happened to feminism where you had the first wave of feminism was really about basic human rights for women, you know, the right to vote, the right to own property, the right to, you know, my parents got divorced in the late 60s, early 70s, and my mom could not get a credit card in her name as a divorced woman. And so the first wave of feminism was really about getting those basic rights to sustain in society. And a lot of the second wave of feminism had to do with things like pornography and the harms pornography and prostitution do to women and to society as a whole. And it had to do with a lot of other things too. But the point is that the reason I emphasize those is because the third wave of feminism has really been about how pornography and prostitution are empowering. And is like, I know Gail Dines, who does a lot of really great anti-porn work, and she teaches, I guess she's retired now, but she used to teach, and she said she would have female students come up to her and say, I don't want to be a feminist because I want to have choice as to who I sleep with. And I don't want to sleep with just any guy who comes on to me. And that was sort of the sex pause third wave. And the point is that feminism was transformed, and you'll see movements for, I mean, it's really interesting that, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into this particular thicket, but then we'll get back to environmentalism in a second. But it's just, this happens to so many movements where, you know, at one point, the Democratic Party at least pretended to care about working class people. And then in the last election, I thought it was really interesting that, and I can't stand Trump. Don't get me wrong on that, but they call a lot of the Trump supporters are working class people, and the Democrats call them deplorables. And I think that's really typical. You know, it's just any movement's going to get captured. Oh, a great example is, you know, you can have unions through the late 19th, early 20th century. Unions were doing some really great work on protecting workers' rights. And then we're all aware of how, you know, by the 40s and 50s, unions were still doing some good work, but a lot of them, I mean, it's just a cliche that they've been captured by the mob. And so there's this part of the problem. One of the reasons this happens is because justice doesn't make money and justice doesn't increase power. And a way to look at this, to bring this back to the environmental movement, one of the problems is that trees have no value until they're cut down. And if you, like, name some any of the animals that you take care of, any species that you take care of there, wild turkeys, I mean, just name a couple of them.
Bears, deer, wild turkeys, raccoons, skunks.
Okay. Does feeding any of those creatures or taking care of them when they're sick, does that make you any money?
So I would correct it to say I don't feed them, that I basically support them through various things like food and water.
Okay, but
no. Okay,
on the other hand, and I'm not suggesting you do this, if you killed the raccoons, you could probably sell their pelts. I mean, I know that I've got friends who fight bobcat trapping around. I mean, so the point is that within this culture, you can make money by not supporting them on their own terms doesn't make any money. And protecting land is not going to make the big funders any money. There's no investment possibility in it. And
what is that turning point in the environmental movement? Because you've obviously studied it in depth, where the progenitors, you know, wherever you want to start it, you know, where they weren't making money, or they had sufficient means, or the culture functioned in such a way where capitalism was not the only route, for example. What was a turning point in terms of individuals who started to engage? Because obviously, I'm just looking at what are the mechanisms. Maybe that's a better way to put it. What are the mechanisms, whether they're psychological, as you say, capitalism, it's always quote unquote financial, which is also psychological. There's a social dimension to it as well. What are those mechanisms which start to kick in?
Well, I think that's another great question, and highlights how I kind of lied to you, because
bright green lies or bright blue lies.
This is just a straight old lie. But you know, when I said that once upon a time environmentalism was about protecting wild place and wild beings, that's true. But also this conflict has been going on for a long time. Yeah. And you've got John Muir, I don't know, 120, 30 years ago. And you also have Gifford Pinchot. And they represent the two sides of that. That John Muir thought that nature should be protected for its own sake. And Gifford Pinchot was all about wise use of resources. That what you do is you, and not wise use like the modern wise use. He would actually be appalled at how aggressively. But he thought that you need to protect them for human use. So it's really a question of whether you value, on one level you could put it, whether you value wild nature for its own sake or whether you value wild nature for human use. But I don't think that's quite accurate. I think it's whether you value wild nature for its own sake or whether you value wild nature for industrial use. Because industrialism has captured all of us. I mean, I'm jumping around here, but something I find really fascinating is that there are mainstream sources of, like mainstream news reports even, will talk about, and various intellectuals will talk about how humans might go extinct within 100 years because of what we're doing to the planet. And they can talk about that fairly blithely, but if you talk about civilization ending, they completely flip out and think you're crazy, because their identification with civilization is stronger than is their identification with human continuance as a species. And Lewis Mumford described that really well. He talks about how various technologies can be either democratic or authoritarian. And a democratic technology would be one that arises from and gives rise to democratic social structures. And an authoritarian technology would be one that arises from and gives rise to authoritarian power structures. And a great example would be pottery or basket weaving are democratic in that really nobody can control your access to reeds. And sure, some people are better than others, but it still doesn't require a police force. On the other hand, mining is an inherently authoritarian technic or technology in that, first off, you have to have a military to take the land because somebody lives on that mine, or somebody lives on the land where the mine's going to go, and that mine is going to destroy their land. Second, and this isn't even including non-humans, and second, that once you get the ore, you need to, excuse me, and you smelt it, you need to have some sort of police force to keep people from stealing it.
But isn't there a step even before that? So, for example, let's say I'm sitting here and I decide to mine for gold pan in my creek for gold. Why? In other words, it's tied into money.
Yep.
And it's tied into something which is, I'm sure you have a better way to describe it. But as I said, you know, deer don't need money and bears don't need money. So to me, when you were giving me the example of the mining, there's something even more fundamental in the sense of it's abstraction. And it is not, in my mind, democratic at all, because it excludes non-humans.
I completely agree with you. And
so democratization, that's what I'm trying to say, is democratization is, or the violation thereof is if it's exclusive to a particular kind of species.
Yes, I would agree with that. And what Mumford says is that, and I agree with this, is that not only do these authoritarian power structure or authoritarian techniques require an authoritarian power structure, but they become authoritarian because they become in charge themselves mm-hmm. of the entire society. And that sounds crazy to think, oh, you know, toasters are in charge. But when you think about a city, are cities designed for human beings or for automobiles? They're designed for cars. And the cars are really in charge of the design. And people talk about global warming and how the fossil fuel industry is killing the planet, et cetera, et cetera. And, well, if it's killing the planet, just stop it. Well, you can't because it's actually in charge. And the same is true. I used to ask people at talks, tens of thousands of people over 15 years, 10 years, do governments take better care of human beings or corporations? You know, once again, forget non-humans. They take better care of human beings, corporations. Not a single person in that time ever said they take better care of human beings. And a corporation is a fiction. It's a creation. It's
with rights.
And so now we can start to move toward how did the transformation take place? Part of the transformation was that we as a collective and most of us individually value this way of living more than we value a living planet. And so, of course, and that's especially true for those in power. And so, of course, that any movement to protect wild beings is going to get co-opted into a movement to maintain this way of life because that's what we value. It's like several years ago, I was noticing that there was a lot less frog song outside than there used to be. And I said this to, when I live in a rainforest, so I mean, there was and should be tons of frog song, and it was going to be less and less. At one point, it was so loud you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night, and now you can still hear it, but it's not as much. And I mentioned this to a local person who had lived here for forever. He's like, really? I had no idea. And the thing is, I can guarantee that if the San Francisco 49er football team disappeared, he would notice. But if the frogs disappear, like, really? I had no clue. And, you know, John Livingston, in his book, The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation, wrote some really interesting stuff about how if you put somebody into an echo chamber, they start to hallucinate. And we evolved hearing just a myriad of voices out in the wild. But now, look at the backgrounds. And for people watching this, look around. What percentage of your sensory perceptions are created by or mediated through human beings or technology? And the answer is almost all of them are created by or mediated through human beings or technology as opposed to being wild beings. And also in one of my books, Welcome to the Machine, I was writing about how, you know, there are those people like what Ray Kurzweil, I think his name is, who say someday humans are going to meld with the machine and we're going to all become one. It's terrifying. But the thing is, he's also late. It's already happened. You know, think about it. How many machines do you have a daily relationship with versus how many wild plants or animals do you have a daily relationship with? I'm not talking to you, Gay, because you probably have more relationship with raccoons than you do with computers. But for most of us, it's the other way around. And think about this. This horrified me when I realized I was writing that book that I touch plastic, like the keyboard. I touch plastic more than I touch flesh. That's horrifying. And so the point is that what John Livingston said, and I agree, is that because we're living in this echo chamber of only human-created sounds and human-mediated sounds, we begin to hallucinate. And he believes that most of our ideologies are hallucinations. And the belief that the stock market going up is a good thing is a hallucination. The belief that you can manage a forest is a hallucination. The belief that you can dam a river without killing it is a hallucination. And so those are some of the sort of deeper roots. And then how it's happened more recently. So it's an interesting story. I don't know if you remember that. Was it 1992 was the big Real Earth Summit? Mm-hmm. And I lived in Spokane, Washington at the time. And it was just an extraordinary, it was an interesting story for me at least, that the representative from the United States delegation to the UN came to Spokane and it was for a public input meeting. And we spent like the entire public participation, which I participated in it, everybody who spoke said, we are opposed to sustainable development, because it's crap. What we're for, because development consists of converting meadows into white box houses. Development's just a euphemism for industrialization. We oppose sustainable development. What we're in favor of is rewilding. We're in favor of deindustrialization. Everybody's saying this, not just me. That's me and my three crazy friends, but everybody is saying this. And we want nature first, et cetera, et cetera. Go through. Everybody says this. And then the guy from the United States delegation to the UN responds, thank you all for your support for the United States position in favor of sustainable development. And the kicker to this story is that I was talking to the person who organized it afterwards, and she said that he was so drunk that he had to be helped to his seat before the thing started. And at first I was really outraged at this. And then a friend of mine said, Derek, how would you feel? And I don't drink at all, but let's pretend I did. How would you feel if you had to go town to town and everybody is telling you that they think that the policy you're supporting stinks, and your job is to every night, as the planet's being murdered, your job is to ignore everything they say and then thank them for supporting the position they didn't. He said, you'd probably get drunk too. But the point that's really interesting about that is that's how the public participation processes really work. There's a great line that I'm going to butcher about, I can't remember her name either, but it's a great line. About how we live in a democracy theme park where, yeah, we get to go in and pull levers and speak in microphones, but they're not attached to anything. And so anyway, what you get is, and I also want to be clear when I'm talking about these mechanisms that there is a big split still within the environmental movement. There are lots of environmentalists all over the world who still are trying desperately to save wild places and wild beings. And there has for a long time been a split between the grassroots organized or the grassroots activists and the big greens, which are basically interlocked. Not basically, they are interlocked with all sorts of corporations and governments. And that's where the money goes. And you have all these small groups and small people, small individuals who are absolutely starved for money, who are, for example, opposing wind energy facilities, are opposing solar energy facilities. All the grassroots on the ground are opposing these, hanging on by their fingernails, hoping to just prevent lithium mines from going in. And then you have the big greens supporting them with all of their money and all of their propaganda. I mean, there's a great line by Henry Adams. The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other purpose than to tell lies where the interests are concerned. He wrote that 120 years ago. And it's certainly just as true today.
So what makes the difference between Gifford Pinchot, Aldo Leopold, and John Muir, for example, in terms of individuals who live more or less at the same time?
Aldo Leopold's a little later.
I think they were a little bit overlapping, yeah. I mean, is the problem also in terms of and again, I don't mean to make this a superficial thing, but in terms of the word, in other words, the term environmentalist. I mean, in my mind, I have to say my gut reaction when I hear that is to really brush that off and not listen until I hear what they're actually proposing. You know, for example, and Charlie Russell, you know, whom I always quote, right? You know, Charlie would always shake his head saying, he said, you know, the environmentalists don't give a, whatever mood he was in, he would use some word, don't give a damn about bears. In fact, they're really anti-bears. The only reason they care about the bears is because they think that that's going to get what they want. And, you know, to me, we're, I guess, you know, this is my broken record, but it comes down to a kind of identity. Now, again, I don't know all the details of John Muir, but I have to tell you, reading him, I mean, he is an ecstatic. You know, same with Enos Mills, who, his identity, I think it comes down to a very fundamental identity. And how can we disable that identity? One of the biggest things, I think, is this allegiance to other humans and the social bond and the fear that is embedded in our relationships. I don't want to go off topic, but I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
No,
I think at the fundamental, at least a corner of it, is very clear that we have a relational problem. We don't like each other as a species. We don't, I mean, again, I'm speaking in kind of a Eurocentric, this little mini globe thing of this culture. We don't like each other. And a lot of the things that happen are because we're afraid of each other. And I think it comes down to something very existential. And that I say is because that, those are the individuals that make the decisions that make, you know, that go down the line. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Well, I agree with almost all of it. And I go back to John Livingston again, and his whole point of the fallacy of wildlife conservation was, as an interesting title, because when I first saw the title, I was like, wait, wildlife conservation is a fallacy? What are you saying? But that's not his point at all. His point is the book, a lot of it goes through to talk about arguments that people make for protecting wildlife and how a lot of them can be converted into more destruction by people who want to convert them into more destruction. And where it comes to in the book, you know, this is sort of the TLDR for his work, is that he thinks it's a state of being, and you can't argue someone who hates nature into loving nature. And he doesn't, he sort of punts on the
TLDR. I'm sorry to be so,
too long didn't read.
Naive. Oh, okay. Okay.
So the one sentence, the clip notes is what our generation would say. And then the young people say TLDR, and I was trying to be cool. Anyway, the Cliff Notes version of his work would be that it's a state of being, and either you love and identify with the natural world or you don't. And I don't think he really talks about whether you can convert people, but it really is. I mean, it boggles my mind that salmon are going extinct and most people don't care. And it boggles my mind that insect populations are collapsing and most people don't care. All this stuff. I mean, there are solid scientists who are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish within less than 30 years now. And I don't know why people, like, who was it? There was this great female, great woman. What's the word for somebody who studies poisons?
Toxicologist?
Yeah, like environmental toxicologist.
Forensics? No.
It was environmental toxicologist, I think, who said, we are bathing the world in endocrine disruptors, and I don't know why everyone isn't running down the street screaming.
Right.
And I don't understand why everybody isn't running down the street screaming on any of these issues. Migratory songbird population collapse, it just doesn't matter. And, you know, my mom died 3 years ago, and she said many, many times in her last 10 years, like, I am so glad that I am not going. I mean, I've seen so much destruction of the world, and I'm so glad that I'm not going to see what comes in the next 15 years because it's just accelerating. And I don't know why people aren't screaming about that. And this is totally punting on my part too, but it's like, it's kind of a state of being. I've written 27 books or something on all this, and I still don't understand why the stuff I'm writing about is not cognitively challenging. You know, there were 60 million bison on the plains, and they're gone. And putting in 60 million cows or 30 million sick cows in the place of 60 million healthy buffalo seems like a terrible idea to me. And putting in dams, I don't understand. You put in a dam, and then the anadromous fish go extinct, and then you're surprised. It's like a toddler who's pushing a plate across the table, and then when it falls off the table, they get surprised. It's like, anyway, the only thing I didn't really agree with is that I don't think it's just this culture. I don't think the problem is that humans don't really get along, because I think, and let me go with this for a second, because it's not quite as bad as it sounds. I think humans are fundamentally, I don't think we're evil. I think we are fundamentally contentious. And I think migratory songbirds are fundamentally contentious too. I mean, I've lived much of my life around chickens, and they're certainly contentious. And I don't know, did I talk about the thing where they recorded what bats were talking about? Mm-mm. Oh, it's really cool. Somebody put a videotape that could obviously capture images in the dark along with audio in a bat roost over winter. And then they recorded all the sounds, and then they watched the tapes to correlate like what would happen with the sounds to try to figure out, start doing a dictionary of what they're saying. And it ends up a lot of what they were doing was squabbling. Sort of saying, hey, you're too close, move away. Or, hey, I'm cold, come over here. Or, you know, whatever. And years ago, I was talking to Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian writer and activist, great human being. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that, you know, we Indians have the same squabbles that white people do. We end up disliking each other. We end up getting in fights. The big difference is that we lived in place, and we know that I know that my great grandchild might marry your great grandchild. Therefore, we have to have ways to get along. Mm-hmm. And then apply the same thing to the non-humans. If you're planning on, you know, people say Indians affected their land base too. And I have seen so many people, this makes me so angry. I've seen so many people use the fact that the Yuroks just south of here would sometimes burn to keep areas open. I've heard them say, well, that means that anything goes on Boise Cascade and Weyerhaeuser can clear cut. I've actually seen people say that. And the big difference is...
Well, there was that book that came out, The Ecological Indian. I don't know if you ever read that by Shepard Kresh.
No, I didn't read that.
And it was absolutely shocking. I mean, he basically said, you know, the Indians are a bunch of, you know... I mean, they're just as quote-unquote bad as us. You know, that's the Cliff Note / TDLR. I think I said that right.
Yeah, you did.
And it was, like, outrageous to see the blurbs on the back of the book of hardcore environmental historians. It was just this piece of bigotry. It was just incredible.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, yes, I agree. And
I mean, that's alive and well.
Yes, it's completely alive and well. And in fact, it's taken over a lot of was an entree into the sort of neo-environmentalism where you get Emma Morris writing Rambunctious Garden, where the entire world is a garden that is supposed to be tended by us, which is just outrageous. And the point is that the difference, and Ray Rafael talked about this, of course, a lot of Indians have talked about this. If you're planning on living in place for the next 500 years, you're going to make different land use decisions than you are if you're not planning on living there. That's the whole thing. Boise Cascade is not planning on living there. Boise Cascade doesn't exist. But the managers aren't planning on living there for 500 years.
That was the whole foundation of the spotted owl debate, right? You know, it wasn't the environmentalist against the logging or the loggers. It was the quote unquote environmentalists against the industry because they had no interest whatsoever in terms of the humans who were doing the work for them.
Right. Well,
let alone nature.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing that was where I got my really entry into all of this work. That was one of the first battles I participated in. And I realized really early on how important the press lies, how important journalistic lies are to this whole discussion, because at the same time that they were saying spotted owls are destroying the timber industry, A, the cut was going up, B, raw log exports were going up, and automation was causing jobs. Mm-hmm. The cut was going up and jobs were going down, but they didn't talk about that. Anyway, back to the original point of being contentious, I think that humans being fundamentally contentious actually also is evolutionarily adaptive. Because I think it kept us in smaller groups. And I agree with Lewis Mumford that the single most important invention of the dominant culture is not the screw or the lever, but what he called the mega machine, which is a machine composed of substitutable parts that are human. And what he means by that is top-down bureaucratic style or top-down military style bureaucracy. And some of the first of those were those armies of construction used for building the pyramids. Mm-hmm. And the reason I think this is really important is because, again, I think humans, I mean, it doesn't mean we're nasty. It's just, you know, I had a wonderful relationship with my mom, but we would still snipe at each other sometimes. I remember one time I was folding my towels at her house, and she came over and said, "Do you want help with that?" And that's what she said. But what I heard her say was, "You're doing it wrong." So the actual conversation went, "Would you like help with that?" And I said, "No." And she's like, "Okay." And I mean, that's
just, there was this really, again, this puts me into the Cliff Note era, but there was this ad on television and this woman is like having a headache and she's making soup on the thing. And her mother comes up and says, "Would you like a little help, dear?" So, you know, and the woman said, "Mother, I'd rather do it myself." And of course the ad comes on for Bayer aspirin or something like that. Anyways, sorry. Reminded me of that.
So it's absolutely extraordinary that you can build up an army of 6 million people to invade Russia, or that you can get an army of 200,000 people or however many people work for Weyerhaeuser to deforest or to sell Coca-Cola or to build a dam or to do.
Well, I think the place thing is absolutely key, because that has been the MO of and continues to be. For indigenous peoples, you know, look at the United States, right, in North America, literally pulling people off the land. I mean, to me, that's the fundamental, that is so profoundly traumatic and destructive. And I think any of those kinds of things like, words, I don't know if David Abram wrote about the spell of the sensuous. I don't know if that's actually his point in the book. I remember I liked it way back when, but there's this notion of words, you know, and our relationship to words and our investment in words like money. In other words, that they are, they're transferable. So to me, that ties all the whole thing into the notion of the place.
Yeah. And another thing we have that, you know, if we want to talk about people regaining their love of nature, I think for me, the foundation of any relationship at all, whether it's with a human or with a place or anything, is time. Mm-hmm. And I remember interviewing Vine Deloria back in the late 90s. And At the time, he taught at the University of Colorado, and he said a lot of his students would go out hiking, and then they would come back and say, oh, I had this great connection with nature. And he would say, no, you really had an aesthetic experience, and you saw some beautiful things, but that's not the same as having a relationship. And I've lived on the same land for 20 years, and it's taken many, many years for me to, it took a few years for the land to even accept me. And then this is kind of woo-woo, but it was pretty miraculous. I knew when the land had accepted me. It's like, yeah, you know, you're a nice enough guy, but you're still, we don't really trust you. I was getting that feeling. And then one day I was walking down a path that I'm the only human who walks on, and I saw a strange footprint, a strange boot print. And so I started walking through the forest, wondering who's here. And I caught this guy who was cutting burls off the land, cutting burls off redwood trees. And I said, you can't do that here. And I walked him off the land. And then he came back and was doing it again the next day. And I walked him off again. He did it one more time, and then he left. And the point is that in the next couple days after that, I saw the biggest pile of bear poop I had yet to see. And nowadays I see bear poop like 50 times a day. And then I saw also the biggest red-legged frog that I still have ever seen. And then on the third day, I'm walking through the forest and a bird flies out of some bushes and brushes my chest with its wing and flies away. And ever since then, my relationship with the land, that was the beginning of the relationship, really, where I felt like I was accepted here. And I had done something tangible to show myself. And, you know, then we can forget the woo-woo part and just go with.
Well, why is that woo-woo?
Because I can see saying this to various friends I had when I was getting my degree in physics 40 years ago, who would say, that's all just random. You just happen to see a big bear poop. I mean, of course, bears poop in the woods. You're going to see bear poop. And so maybe I shouldn't have made the caveat, and I'm fine with not making it too.
Well, anyway, I'm just trying to say from a perspective, this is not for you. This is just sort of a little bit of a side text, is that birds and bears and frogs and trees are sentient.
Of course.
And they're very observant. This is where they live. Everything is very important to them. And so in some kind of way, they understood your intention. They understood the other person's attention. And this was a way of interacting and communicating something.
Yes, I completely agree. And thank you for calling me on stepping.
Well, I'm only saying that is because this is another example of what I call how science, which is selective. So, you know, right. Your physics friend is not taking into account the entirety corpus of science, quote unquote. And all of those things are true. And this notion, you know, just like even the people who are recording the bats and things like that, that it's not implemented. I'm only saying that, not criticizing you. I'm just saying is that, it makes sense. I mean, if you, for example, were in a town and similar things had happened, like you saw someone, you know, defacing a statue, you know, you moved, you know, it's like a Richard Rohr has this thing about, I don't know, we've forgotten what town, it was Germany or Switzerland, that's right. And anyways, he's this priest and he was talking about how, you know, he said it was, you know, Sunday and no one was around. And, you know, there's no traffic and he's in this small town and he crosses the road. And this man opens up his window, right? And he starts, you know, yelling at him in Swiss German saying, use the sidewalk. I mean, or use the crosswalk. You know, use the crosswalk. So I guess I see something like that. So if you were in that town, you know, you would be understood as a foreigner or someone's, you know, an outsider. And if you had done things that showed that you respect the place, I think people act differently.
Yeah, I yes.
Well, like one guy might come up and say, "Hey, you know, do you want to go have a beer?" Another person, you know, says, "You know, I'd really like you to meet my family and go ahead and take a shit on the lawn." And you know, I mean, I'm just saying is, you know, I really think that's the understanding of quote unquote sentience is really dropping down to the level of commonality. So anyways, I didn't mean to wax on about
that. No. I think that's incredibly important. I think that's hugely important.
But I think that's what you were feeling and picking up and understanding. And I think it's just a fact. That's what it is.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we all communicate differently. And that's one reason that the story with my mom is kind of interesting because, you know, I had at that point, this is 15 years ago, so I had 45 years of experience with her at that point. And we both spoke English and we still had miscommunication. And it's extraordinary to me that so often it's the non-humans who are taking the initiative to attempt to bridge these species communication gaps between us. And and another story just about a way we communicate. I used to have some different dogs than I have now. This is many, many years ago. And they lived with me, and then I would walk up to my mom's, where I am now, and then they would stay outside at my mom's. And when I would leave, they would always, if I was going to go into town, they would not even get up off lying down on the porch. But if I was going to walk home, they would get up and go with me. And it took me, they started doing this almost immediately. And it took me a couple years to figure out what they had figured out immediately, which is if I walk out of the house with car keys in my hand, I'm going into town and they don't need to bother to get up off the porch. But if I don't have car keys in my hand, and again, they figured that out almost immediately. And it took me 2 years of thinking that they were reading my mind they were in a sense, but anyway, so they were a lot smarter than I am or was. But back to the original point, I always used to think that people who were good at tracking or anything, it was like this magical skill. But one day last summer, and this sort of thing happens all the time, this is just one of them, I was walking on some obscure path in the forest, and I saw a pile of bear poop, and I immediately knew which bear's poop it was. And that's simply from knowing them. And this is how you learn to read a book, how you learn to read text in a book is by practice and by just enjoying it. And I mean, the way I found that guy with the boot, the way I found him was, and I can't believe this because I'm like, I'm not a tracker at all, but I noticed a branch by the path that was broken, not at the level that a bear would break it. And it's like, oh, I'll bet he went down this path. Of course, it could have been an elk or something because it was, you know, it's shoulder length for an elk and it was, you know, sort of rib height for a human. But the point is, the only reason I knew that is because I walked that path every single day and I got to know it. It's not study any more than you study someone you're in a long-term relationship with. It's just you get to know them. And I once asked both Jeanette Armstrong and Linda Hogan, how does someone become indigenous? And they said, you know, how long does it take? And they both started talking about the hill people of, you know, the Appalachians, and how it takes, you know, really a couple hundred years, and it takes long enough for your stories to develop in place and for your family to get to know the place well enough that you can tell to see the patterns is really the point. You know, I remember reading something by Winona LaDuke one time about how many, many years ago, her people had stories. I think it was her people had stories about maybe every 6 or 7 human generations, there would be a big migration of, I think it was either Fishers or Martin, the weasels. And, you know, you got to live in place a long time to see something that happens every 6 or 7 generations, you know. And 10 years ago or so, I was really excited because one summer there was this explosion of redwood millipedes here. They're pretty cool, and they smell like almonds because their defense mm-hmm. is cyanide. And I was really excited because they hadn't been here the previous years, and they live for many years in the duff before they come up. And so I was thinking, yay, the forest is doing well enough that there's enough duff for them to be here. But they were only here for a couple, 3 years, and I haven't seen any since. So do I need to be worried about that? Or is that, I have no idea, and I won't know until, you know, 60 years have passed mm-hmm. and 60 more years. So I was just mentioning, I don't think, you know, that was a fantasy that a lot of environmentalists used to have many years ago that I used to always hear, is if we could just get a CEO to go out and spend a weekend in a wilderness, that would cure them. It's like, no. If you can get them to go out for 4 generations, then maybe. But, you know, it's like, this is a beautiful redwood forest here, and there was a family member visiting, and the first thing he was saying is, wow, this is worth a lot of money. You could sell these trees for a lot. It's like, him being here for a weekend did not change his perspective. He still saw the trees as dollar bills.
So let's just reel back a little bit, and this is in continuity with what you just said about your relative and things like that, or the CEO going out of vines. I'm sure he had something even more wry to add on to that. But anyways, about why aren't people screaming and stuff, and
because.
What can they do to start? What can they do to start? I mean, in other words, I think people are screaming. I think that they are, you know, what's the, you know, the guy, the scream, you know, what was his name? The Norwegian guy that did the scream. I think they are, but where does one start? And I'm not, and I think one is very diverse. In other words, how does one start? And that's why I asked you about the fundamental mechanisms, like when you were talking about being in place and staying in place, the decisions that we make. I think that really is the crux right there.
So what is your question?
Well, I mean, what does one do? What would you tell people? You know, they said, I am screaming. I just read this article. I had to take a bunch of sedatives. I had to get drunk. I had to, you know, whatever, you know, I had to eat 4 pizzas, before I could even walk out the front door. What do you tell someone to help unlock and to move toward this different, you know, something that is going to quote unquote change things?
Well, it's really difficult because, I look around and I see also a lot of people who are profoundly traumatized, both through personal trauma and larger social trauma. And that takes enough work by itself that most people don't do it. And years ago, I love this story. So when I was first doing talks on Endgame, I would talk about taking out dams. And one of my most famous lines is, every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. And one time at a talk, a hydrologist said, you know, you never should say that. That's incredibly irresponsible. because the worst thing people can do is take out a dam, is blow up a dam. It's just horrible. And I started asking people about that. And then people pointed out to me, like, the Missoula flood was absolutely immense, and salmon and sturgeon survived that, but they're not surviving the dams. And so I thought, I'm just going to call a bunch of wildlife biologists or fisheries biologists and ask them. And for better or for worse, I have this very sincere, I mean, I'm sometimes kind of stupid because I'm not very good at being cagey. So I just called them up and said, hey, so if somebody blew up a dam, would that actually be good or bad for the river? Click. And they're all like, they think they're talking to a terrorist or something. So I was like, oh, that's why they're all hanging up on me. So I changed it and I started calling and said, so let's pretend it's 50 years from now and the entire grid has collapsed. The electrical grid has collapsed and people are considering removing a dam on a local river. And you don't have the means to do it slowly. So your choice is either blow it up. You're not going to kill any humans because the humans are going to leave for a little while and come back. And is it better to blow up the dam or to wait until the dam fails on its own for the river? You're supposed to speak only for the river's perspective. And they're all like, oh, come on. It's just a failure of dam failure. It's just a big flood. And rivers flood all the time. And in fact, rivers get dammed all the time. And that's not the problem. You know, there'll be lava flow. There'll be a log jam. There'll be a landslide. Rivers get dammed. The problem is, naturally, the problem is that all the rivers are dammed everywhere. It's not just one or two. You know, salmon don't care if one river has a landslide and they lose a bunch of habitat for the 3 years it takes for the river to cut through it again. And so they're all like, yeah, it's no big deal. It's actually just a big flood. And then I was talking to a fisheries biologist up on an undammed river on the Olympic Peninsula, and she absolutely adores the river that she studies. And she said, you know, it floods all the time. We misdefine rivers. We always think that rivers are static, but they're not. They writhe like snakes across the landscape. They dance, you know, they move, they change where they go into the ocean. They change course all the time. And she said, every single time that the river changes course, it breaks my heart because I think of all the deer, all the otters, all the fish, all the frogs, all the trees who get killed, in this violent action of it changing course. And at the same time, every time it changes course, I am ecstatic because this is how new habitat is created. And she said the concern is always, or not the concern, but she said, what I end up feeling is sorrow for the short-term loss and joy for the long-term habitat gain. And when she said that, it occurred to me, that's why people stay in jobs they don't like. Because they're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. That's why they stay in relationships they don't like. That's why we don't bring down civilization, because we're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. And part of the problem on the big scale is that collectively we are so terrified of this short-term habitat loss for the long-term planetary habitat gain that so many of us do nothing. So now to your question, when people ask me what they should do, I always give the same answers, which are it's several answers, usually in forms of questions. The first one is, what do you love? And whatever you love, it's under assault. If you love bears, they're under assault. If you love salmon, they're under assault. If you love long-form discourse, it's under assault. If you love independent bookstores, they're under assault. If you love independent publishers, they're under assault. If you love democracy, it's under assault. If you love women's rights, they're under assault. And so the big distinction is not between those who want to bring down civilization and those who don't. And I would say the big distinction is not even between those who are biocentric and those who are not. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And the smartest decision I ever made was when I was in my 20s. I knew that everything was messed up. I knew that there was, you know, the planet's being killed. And the problems are so big, it's like, I can't do anything. I can't fix anything. I don't know what to do. So I didn't do anything. And then one day I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline. That gas at the time cost, I don't know, a buck a gallon or something. And that doesn't cover the social and ecological costs. So what I decided is that for every dollar I spend on gas, I would give a dollar to a local environmental organization, not national, but local. But I didn't have any money. So for all the money I spent on gas, I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. That's how I started in all this. So I started by writing letters to the editor, and I was so scared I wouldn't use my own name. And then I started doing anti-circus demos and anti-fur demos. And I didn't let anything. I love Florence Nightingale's line about how she accomplished so much. She said, I never gave nor took any excuses. And it was the same. It's like, if I spend $10 on gas, I'm going to do 2 hours of activism. And when I did the anti-circus demo, it's like I didn't have a sign. I didn't have anything. I just knew circuses are cruel. I didn't know why. And so I'm standing there holding my sign. Circuses are bad. Some guy comes up to me and says, so why are circuses bad? And I said, I don't know. Ask the guy next to me. You know, it's like I didn't let my ignorance stop me. So, and then I did anti-war demos, and I did, and then I started doing timber sale appeals, and then the activism was got to be so much fun that I just quit keeping track. So the point is, what do you love? Find something you love. Next is, what do you love doing? Because, you know, I write so many books and people say, gosh, aren't you burned out? I was like, no, I love doing what I do. And on the other hand, I write really terrible press releases, for example. I remember working for volunteering for an environmental organization. They said, Derek, you're a writer. Write a press release for us. I spent 8 hours writing this thing that was useless as a press release, handed it to them. They said, thanks so much for doing this, threw it in the wastebasket, took 15 minutes to write their press release, and there it was. And I was really terrible at doing timber sale appeals too. I would be just digging through these environmental impact statements and environmental assessments. Just my mind is going crazy. And the people who really knew what they were doing would come into the room. They would sit down, take the environmental impact statement from me, look on one page and say, there, we got them right there, 36 CFR 19. I'm like, why did I spend the last 6 hours like randomly looking at things? Or another example is I was working with to protect some forests. I was working with an attorney who I was helping her. And the way I was helping her is she had me write her legal briefs. I mean, she had me write drafts of them so that she could more easily then do the final draft. And A, my writing style was just terrible for legal stuff. And B, so then I started writing it in her legal style. And I said to her, do you like doing this stuff? Do you get off on writing this crap? And she's like, oh yeah, I love it. I mean, so I have a very specific niche that I love filling. Oh, another example. I've given talks. The biggest talk I ever did was 10,000 people. I've given talks before 1,000 people, 500 people. And I don't even think about it before, you know, like I'm going to go on stage in 2 minutes. Like, well, I should probably figure out what I'm going to say. It's like, I don't get nervous, anything. It's all easy. But they asked me to do a phone tree for an environmental organization where I call and invite people who are members of the organization to dinner. I spent the entire evening dialing 6 numbers of a 7-number phone number and then freaking out, and I couldn't dial. I did not make a single call because I'm so introverted. And likewise, one time we were supposed to do a door hanging. There was 3 of us walking around. We're hanging environmental information on people's doorknobs. I stood in the middle of the seat because I was terrified somebody was going to come to the door. And then I'd have to talk to them. It's like, I can't do that. I had a friend. One time I asked her, oh, what are you doing this afternoon? And I said, well, I'm kind of bored, so I'm going to go stand outside Walmart and leaflet. It's like, you're going to go talk to strangers on purpose? And people will say, Derek, you need to stop writing and become an organizer. Okay, this is my scratch paper pile. This is my scratch paper organization. It's like, I am not an organizer. I can't organize my pens, you know? And I don't like talking to people. And this is different because we're doing a event thing. But informally, that's why I said when the phone rings, I swear. And, you know, I'm not one of those extroverts, crazy people. Anyway, so find out what you get off on doing. You know, I get off on trying to figure out the relationships that we're talking about between, I don't know, perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. And so find what you get off on and then do that and use it in service of whatever it is you love. And then the other thing I say to people is, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? And then the other thing, there's a couple more. One of them is, what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? One of the reasons I write the books I do is because there was a hole in discourse. And instead of just complaining that there's a hole in discourse, it's like, okay, I should just do it. And if you see a problem, fix it. Work toward fixing it. And then the last thing is, no matter where you are, get to know those around you. And in terms of, you said supporting, I feel exactly the same way about supporting non-humans. Non-humans are refugees in their own homes. And however we can support them is incredibly important, not only for this at the species level, but also on the individual level and in making friendships. These are your neighbors. And get to know them. And you'll like some of them and not like some of them. And no matter, this is true no matter where you live. Years ago, I wrote a book against zoos. And one of the arguments in favor of zoos is that children need to see non-humans. I completely agree that children need to see non-humans, but there's a few problems. One of them is that that zoos teach the wrong lessons, zoos do many wrong lessons. One of them is that you can remove a wolverine from its habitat and still have a wolverine. It teaches that the wolverine is a bag of DNA. I mean, it's a bundle of DNA and a sack of skin, as opposed to the wolverine and its relationships with all of its habitat. And it also teaches that they're there and I'm here. And it also teaches that they are there. I went to, before I did the book, I went to a zoo and it was the Detroit Zoo, and there was this sing song thing that you push a button and it would play a little sing song for the kids. All the animals at the zoo are waiting here just for you. What lesson does that teach? That's horrible. And so the lesson, what I say in the book is that if you want to see a bear, you need to live such that a bear wants you to see him or her. And if you want to see a raccoon, you need to live such that the raccoon wants to be seen. And then I started sharing that with some people, and they said, well, what about people in cities? So I went to what I perceived would be, or what I guessed would be, the most animal unfriendly place in this town, which is the parking lot outside McDonald's. And I just got out of the car and I sat next to these bushes and I saw a one-legged seagull. I saw a couple other seagulls and I saw some bumblebees on some of the bushes there, and I saw ants. So there's no excuse anywhere you are. Anywhere you are, you can see some nature. And you can establish a relationship with that nature, with those beings, and you can attempt to understand their perspective, and you can attempt to share with them your perspective. And the big thing is, get off your butt. So those are the things that I think that people should do to start. And just recognize that the non-humans who surround you, their lives, including the plants, their lives are just as valuable to them as yours is to you. And there's all sorts of communications going on. And I'll say this too, because I just think it's so fascinating. So I live in Northern California and I don't do drugs, but, marijuana really helps my Crohn's disease. I drink the juice, which just tastes awful, but I juice leaves. And then anyway, so I got aphids a while back and I don't want to spray or anything. And it's like, what am I going to do with aphids? And they get more and more aphids because I'm sitting here doing nothing. And finally I get this idea, which is I take the plants outside and just put them out there. And the cool thing is that within 10 minutes, there are wasps showing up who aren't eating the aphids, but they are eating the honeydew. Mm-hmm. And then the really cool thing, this is the reason I'm telling this whole story, is within a day, so 24 hours later, I go back out and there's all these little itty bitty black specks. And I look in the magnifying glass at the little black specks, and the black specks are wasps the size of a period on a piece of paper. And what those are parasitic wasps. And what they do is they lay eggs inside the aphids, and bad for the aphids. They lay eggs inside the aphids, and then it's like the scene in Alien. You know, they grow inside, and then they burst out. And the thing that's really cool is that the plants send out messages, chemical messages, to the surrounding area saying, hey, there's a bunch of aphids here. When I lived in Spokane.
Garage sale.
Feast. When I lived in Spokane, there was a tree got covered with aphids outside. And I didn't do anything because I didn't know what to do. And within about a week, it was covered with these little orange and black worms that I soon realized were ladybug larvae. And it was the same deal. The tree had sent out messages saying garage sale, saying whatever. And the reason I bring all this up is because it just gives me chills to think about how much communication there is going on in nature that we have absolutely no clue. We are not physically equipped to detect the smell that the plant gives off to call the wasps. And so another thing I want people to do is I want for people to open themselves up to recognizing those possibilities and recognizing those realities and to do exactly what you did with me to say, no, this isn't woo-woo. This is just their communication. They're just being themselves. And heck, they're even trying to communicate with you.
Well, I'll give you a co-introvert little ending here from me is that people say, oh my God, you know, you're such a recluse. And, you know, you just like, don't you like get lonely and like, don't you want to socialize and this? And I said, you know what? I said, I am so happy when I can go outside with a glass of wine just by myself and just have my glass of wine, because it's like living in a city here. There's so much going on. All these conversations, not only the, you know, the animal, the, what I call the faculty residents here that are in the sanctuary as such, but all the stuff that's going, I mean, it is so, when I say noisy, I mean, there's so much going on and so much in terms of processing and, you know, that it's like an overload. So for me, you know, it's like, you know, I get a few minutes of, it's like the deer when they get pregnant, you know, they start walking around, they get bigger and bigger and bigger, right? And I always say, you know, it's like, you know, pregnant females, well, probably not now, you know, the swollen ankles, you know, I just want to sit down, smoke a cigarette, have a cup of coffee, right? Can this be over kind of thing, you know? So I really appreciate you're saying that, because it is, you don't have to have any special, I'm not special at all. You know, I'm just like a total goober. And yet I'm open to knowing and hearing. And so it's like everyone's talking about me or around me or, you know, stuff is going on in that way. So, you know, I do think it's wonderful to have refined and like you, you know, you develop the sensibilities and the sensitivity. You know, I remember talking to Vine years ago and I'm like, you know, how do I listen to a tree? You know, I have these oak trees that are 400 years old, you know, and it's like, how do I learn tree? You know, and he said, just start. He says, shut up and listen, you know, and, you know, I mean, I'm nothing like his, I think it was his grandfather who was the great bison talker. You know, he'd go out and, you know, have a cigarette together. I mean, metaphorically or whatever, talking about things. And it's a big news. I mean, it was a big newsy kind of thing, you know, cause obviously the bison was huge, right? For the Lakota Sioux. And, so, you know, I don't have any of that sophistication and I probably will never have that kind of level of sophistication. But the thing is I think a large part of it, like you're saying, if you just listen and are receptive and know it's there, without it, you know, I mean, know this is happening, that you're in the soup of dialogue and conversation and contention, maybe, you know, that you really, that's all to me also how we quote unquote reconnect with nature.
And did I tell you last time the story about the bear my mom had a long relationship with?
Well, you mentioned.
And did I say about the bear coming back when she was dying?
Yeah. Well, no, okay. Why don't you, do you mind iterating?
No, I just didn't want to bore your readers if they'd heard it, or listeners if they'd heard it before. But my mom had this long relationship with this one bear. We called her Mama. And then Mama disappeared for years. We don't know if she's dead, whatever. And then my mom got cancer and she's dying of cancer. And about a week before she entered terminal delirium, Mama, having not been here for almost a decade, shows up on her porch. Mm-hmm. And my mom couldn't believe what she saw. And then she said, so either she's telling me I'm going to get better. She's telling me goodbye. And I knew she wasn't telling her she was going to get better. So I said to her, well, she's telling you it's going to be okay. But I mean, I've read about these stories, like the one about the guy in Africa who had the relationship with the elephants. And then when he died, they all came and walked on his grave they came from like miles around. And the same thing happened with this guy who had a wild goose sanctuary in North Carolina. I think Gaddy was his name, that when he died during his funeral, all the geese were standing there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I saw the same thing with my own eyes, you know, that she hadn't been here for 10 years and somehow she knew my mom was dying and came back to say, it's been nice knowing you and I'll see you on the other side.
Well, thank you both for sharing today. I know that time is a little bit tight, but also for the reminder that there is magic, not just in our technology, right, but also and even more so in the natural world, and also the magic of showing up, I think, is a huge thing. So thank you very much, Derek. Thank you, Dr. Bradshaw, for being here. And once again, I'll just plug your book real quick so that folks, if they want to read more, can go out and get it. It's called Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Thanks, Derek. It was lovely.
Thanks. Let's do it again.
What's your next book you're working on?
Well, I have a book that's at the publisher right now it's called Marijuana, A Love Story. It's about how legalization has been a complete disaster for the small growers, and it's been a transfer of wealth from family farmers to big corporations. And at the same time, it's an exploration of the completely, and I mean this in a good sense, the completely insane culture surrounding small-scale marijuana growing, both the good stuff, like all the single mothers who could trim at home and no longer can, and the bad stuff too, like the rampant theft and sexism, both of that. Anyway, so that's that book. And then I'm working on a book right now, about halfway through, about, stopping rape culture. I'm about halfway, two thirds way through that. And then the next book I'm going to do after that is going to be about my mom's death. And then the next book after that is going to be about my relationship with bears.
Impressive.
Well, it's the same. This is another thing I should have said, but I didn't, is that, you know, my mom had this great line that she got from her grandmother, which is inch by inch, life's a cinch. And so the way I write a book is I write a page and then I write a page and then I write a page. And, you know, and in a year I got a book. And because this writing a book is too scary. It's too big. It's too, I don't know if that's how you did it, Gay, but it's or how you do it. And it's the same with stopping this culture. You know, you can't eat the monster in one bite. You got to do bite by bite.
Well, I haven't written 27 books. No, I have no formula. You know what I mean? And each one is sort of different. The turning point for me is, has been, I mean, like I said, I don't have 27 books, so I can't really say an inch and a cinch. But the stumbling block for me is I have to have the image. You know, it's sort of like I have to have the whole. And when that happens, sometimes I just kind of, you know, like this, because writing has turned out to be somewhat of a meditation for me. I know that sounds kind of weird, but it grounds me, you know. At the same time, I have a voice saying, you know, kind of like that thing from Jack Nicholson. I didn't see the movie, but, you know, he's the crazy and he's writing like mad, and his wife comes in and finds out that he's been writing all work and no play. Like, yeah. Right. So, you know, that's a voice in me that says, you know, like, what the hell are you doing? This is useless. Do something constructive in the world. More world doesn't need more your words. I'm not saying you or Liz. Cause she's wrote a beautiful dissertation, very beautiful, the film. It's become a meditation. But really, like this one, actually I have two things going on. One is a co-author thing, and I'll probably burden you with that. But the other one is something that is kind of organic, and I kind of turn a corner on it and then it happens. Do you know what I mean? And then usually it takes me, you know, like 3 months or something to write the book.
Oh, wow. That's great.
I mean, that's been what I've done. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Aside from Carnivore Minds, which also does, but that one was painful. It's all this biology shit that I had to learn, right? I had to go through these awful biology. I hope we don't record this. I mean, it's just like, oh my God, you know, I had to read these papers on biology. I mean, it's just like I wanted to shoot myself, right? Because I had to have enough quote unquote knowledge of, right, from the biological perspective of a particular species umbrella in order to be, you know, accepted and also speak the lingua, you know, the lingua, bit of that. But no, it's, that's beautiful, wonderful. No, I don't plan. You're a true writer. You know, I these are just little things that kind of pop out for me in certain ways.
Nah. Your stuff's really good. I really like it.
Well,
it's really important stuff.
We'll see. Thanks so much for this, and say hi to the bears and the aphids. Aphids get a bad rap.
Hi to the bears, bye to the aphids.
Well, have a great day.
Okay, lots of love.
Thanks,
bye, Liz. Take care.